Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Donna McKechnie,
who plays
Mabel
in the pajama game.
My now, character voice.
Yeah, there it was. She slipped into it briefly. Yeah. Pajama game now at Arena Stage, now through, what are the dates, do you remind me?
December 24th.
December 24th, now through December 24th. Everyone come out and see it. Thanks so much for joining us. This is, you're a legend of the industry, and we just really appreciate you joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, really. I've had the best time here at Arena Stage.
Why is that?
I just want to get that in. Because
get it in a little bit more.
I've always wanted to work here. It's just such a well-oiled machine and so professional at the same time. They, in a very short time, create a safe place to really create. It's not like stamping them out in, you know, regional theater, usually.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the current Broadway chant started here. Dear Evan Hansen, it started here
before going out there. That's right.
You said you've always wanted to work here, so this is the first time?
Yes, it is. Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Tell me what makes Molly so impressive.
Just the overview she has of what theater is for her, but also her sense of community and all the outreach that she does. And it's just a deeply heartfelt thing. I don't know her that well, but I can just tell every room she comes in, it's effective the way she communicates with people. And after the show, when we have a talk back with the audience, she's there and to, you know, moderate, but really to make the connection with the sponsors always, but the people who maybe haven't come to this theater. You know, and she invites the cast to participate, and it's a great thing.
You said when she walks in the room, but when you walk in the room, it's the same effect. That's great. All right. Well, before we get, I guess, too far in, let's back up and pretend that maybe our listeners haven't seen the Pajama Game. It's hard to believe, but give us a brief sort of premise. I know it's sort of based on the book, what, 7.5 cents, and so it's about trying to get, you know, 7.5 cent pay increase. But just give them a little summary.
And to get a union together for these workers.
Almost like the Norma Rae of
That's a good way to describe it. And it has all these off-shooting relationships that, you know, Mabel, it's not on the written page, but Ed Gera, who is a wonderful actor here.
We know him well. He's come on several times. He did Scalia.
He's fantastic. You know, so we are able to bring what I call I'm the office wife, you know. So but that's the fun of creating it. So we have these little spats. And it's about relationship in the workplace. And we talked about it last night, that now this new thing coming up that's shifting our culture a bit about sex in the workplace. Mm-hmm.
It's the time person of the year.
And how far do you go where it's inappropriate? And what are the boundaries? And people are unsure about this in a culture when, I mean, when I was growing up in show business in New York in the 50s, late 50s, it was just something that you had to just expect that was going to happen. You had no recourse, it felt like, you know. So this is very different.
And it's about factory workers, and there's, you know, romance going on. So this is so timely.
And it's a love story. Yeah. And it happens in a kind of awkward way in the beginning, because it is in the workplace. And he's this new superintendent, and, you know, she's the committee, the complaint committee. And she's trying to protect the worker, and they get into and he's very attracted. She's very attracted. So all these elements come out, and we stay true to the original script, which was it's just kind of sexist in a way, like a Doris Day movie, like a woman has her place.
And this is 1960s.
Yeah, that's right. And even in the reprise of Hey There, originally, Brittany Coleman, who was brilliant as Babe, she started singing a reprise of the song, and then it ended with her getting upset and she couldn't finish the song. And it's just about, it's not a victim, but it's about how she's not strong and she's taken over by emotion. So the choice was made by Alan Paul, our director, to complete the song and be strong, even though there's a lot of feeling and maybe She feels that soft about it, but she has to persevere.
So that's how it's changed slightly.
And it helps, makes it more palatable, but yet the message, we never change the dialogue, it's there. So and sometimes the people even gasp when they hear things. You're the cutest thing I've seen. And, you know, those kind of lines that come out in there, like, oh, that's not right.
So do you sort of, in the current context, you sort of view those lines in a way that like a Mad Men or something would be? It's
yes,
almost a
right.
time capsule of that era that we can now look back, and those gasps are almost healthy in a way, you know?
I think so, and I wouldn't want it to be any other way than the way, this is a slice of our history, and
right.
I think it's important to have that reflection, you know? This is, and I was there, so.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of which, so, I mean, huge, huge hit back in, you know, in the 60s, it won Best Musical, the revival, you know, back in 06, I think, won Best Revival, and so it's been a hit all along the way, but just to drill on down further on what we were talking about, you guys could have never predicted what would have happened this year with all of the scandals. I mean, every titan of every industry, not even just Hollywood, is starting to fall over this. You know, it's a tidal wave, and there'll be more to come.
It's more to come.
Every big person you can imagine will probably come up.
In every area.
Yeah. But just what are you... I guess you guys couldn't have predicted that at all coming into this show. But so when audiences come and see that, do you think it's going to be top of mind? Or are they coming to see the show ready to gasp at that? Or is it just a natural reaction?
I just think it's spontaneous. And I think that they don't know. If they haven't seen it, they don't know the show.
Yeah.
It's going to be, it's ever present.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's subliminal, it's there. So... And I think it's effective, and I think that's part of the job of our theater is to communicate and reflect. And the interpretation by the actors, by the director, is what changes it.
Yeah.
In other words, it's on the page. We respect the writing, the intent. You know, you can't stay true to the intent, but you can interpret it within, you know, bounds.
Absolutely. Give us an idea of what, when our listeners come out, and it's radio, so we're going to have to paint a mental picture here, but what they're going to see, because it's the sleep tight pajama factory,
that's what it's called,
I'm imagining. Well, honestly, they kind of did something similar in Kinky Boots with the factory of the shoes, but this was way before kind of setting the
but
precedent.
You know what, with this, because I did two shows directed by George Abbott, who was the original director, and... it's like those classic old musicals. They're 2 inches off the floor, I call it.
I love that.
it's like they're up there. The energy is high. And I have to say how the score is great.
Yeah.
The score, the dancing, Parker Essie, our choreographer, created incredible dances, brought Michael Danziger, who's a very well-known dance arranger, a musician, a songwriter. Michael Danziger created all new dance arrangements, and Parker opened up, especially for my number, which wasn't a dance number at all, really, just a little soft shoe, he opened that up to make it more song and dance for the two of us. And the dancing is extraordinary. Every audience that sees it, I mean, that's one of the first things they say, besides the gorgeous score. And I'm still trying to find out, maybe you can help. There's a rumor has it that Frank Lesser, who was a mentor to these writers, wrote two songs, and one of them, I think, is Hey There.
Okay, and we're trying to figure out what the other one is?
Yeah, I don't know how we can uncover that, but... It's been
I'll look it up and
around.
Put it in the... okay,
yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. I'll look it up.
Because that's when, in the day when, you know, they would bring trunk songs out and, you know, from someone else, you know, they would help each other.
That's awesome. All right, we'll definitely look that up and put it in the piece.
A little trivia there.
Do you have... go into some of the other songs, because we remember Hey There, and there's a Hey There reprise. List some of the other ones for me. Which ones, when you're watching from the wings there, you're like, ooh, I can't wait to see
there
that.
There are
do
no
that
wings.
Oh. Well, that's a figure of speech.
Which is the fun of it, you know. It's in the round, so it's
when you're watching from the round, which ones do you love seeing your co-stars do night and night?
Hernando's Hideaway is great. And Steam Heat. You can hear the audience recognize the beginnings of both of those songs, and they feel like they're, you know, with a comfortable friend all of a sudden. They haven't, you know, you don't hear these songs. as much anymore. And they were, I think, they were very popular on radio. Yeah. And people recorded them. And
yeah. Awesome. All right, I want to go all the way back. Growing up in Pontiac, Michigan, right? Is that where you were born?
I was born there, but I didn't live there.
Where'd you actually grow up?
I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, Royal Oak, Michigan.
Okay. So you know a little bit about the whole factory, you know? It wasn't pajamas, but it was cars.
That was the background.
Yeah.
Tool and die manufacturing, right.
So you can relate a little to that, factory elements. So what how did you actually, so in that, you know, that we're talking about, you know, it's like a huge auto industry. How do you fall for musicals? Was it seeing, I read somewhere you saw The Red Shoes or what?
That's exactly it. It's a typical story almost. And we found out that it was typical when we all sat around talking about why we started dancing. For most it was going to the movies. The movies gave us so much, you know. I didn't know there was a New York. I mean, I knew about New York when I was very young because of all the Sid Charisse, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers. And The Red Shoes literally changed my life.
Palin Pressburger.
Pardon me?
Michael Palin Emmerich Pressburger.
Yes. And so my mother was my champion, and she found, I was very lucky that there were two really great teachers in the Detroit area, Pamela Dunworth in Dearborn and Rosemary Floyd in Royal Oak. And they're still with us, and, you know, they don't teach anymore, but they're wonderful women. And I had this great ballet training, which is, when I talk to young dancers, I say, whatever you do, just keep doing your ballet, because that is going to take you wherever you need to go, style-wise.
Why is that? Explain that. Why is that the core of what everything
because
else can branch
from? When you dance, you're asking your body, as you're growing up with dance, to do these unnatural things that aren't meant to be. So you have to have a technique to find your way there, and also to protect yourself from injury. You have an ability to keep your muscles intact, to stretch, to, you know, you have a technique.
That's so fascinating. Meryl Streep was just saying the same thing at the Kennedy Center Honor. She was coming out to salute Carmen de Lavallade and was saying that she had her as a, I guess she taught some sort of, it was an acting class at Yale, but they brought in this, you know, famous dancer choreographer to teach them about exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So I think you're exactly right.
Right.
That's amazing. All right. So then how do we move to New York? You go there.
It's going to be a long story. Yeah, I'll try to make it short.
Yeah. But didn't you join radio? You tried out for Radio City?
That was one of my first jobs, because I ran away from home to join this dance group. I think my parents were hoping I would come home, and if they didn't support me, send me money, whatever. And so it kind of fueled my passion to keep working and to show them that I could do it and I could be okay. So it was a desperate thing for me to keep working on my own and not expect support. I got a job when there was a ballet corps at Radio City that's no longer there. And for 5 days, I think, I did it.
Just 5 days?
And I got West Side Story. But I was so young and naive, I didn't know that you had to give notice. So they thought I was hit by a truck. The costume was made. We did our dress rehearsal. It was horrible.
They thought you were hit by a truck. They didn't hear the snapping off? They should have known where you were. Who were you?
It was embarrassing anyway. I can talk about it now, perhaps.
Yeah, now we can, all these years later. No, but what was the West Side Story? Was this a tour? Or was it?
It was a tour. Frank Cassaro directed it. So many dancers that that did the show, you know, after Robin's first cast.
Which started down here, by the way, in D.C. Oh. National Theater, very first, because Cheetah Rivera is D.C. native, yeah.
Wow,
isn't
that's
crazy?
Right, of course.
There you go.
Wow, it's fantastic. So those were my, you know, my heroes, all those West Side Story people, and they became my dance teachers in New York for jazz, and, you know, and then it was just audition.
Yeah. So, all right. So you audition. You finally make your Broadway debut in It's How to Succeed in Business.
Right,
is that what it was?
Right.
And there you meet Bob Fosse, right?
Bob Fosse and Gwen
Verdon. And any legends working on that one. But, all right, explain what you learned from those two. I mean, you're young and impressionable coming up. But working with them, that elevates you immediately. It has to.
And what I loved about it was that Bob Fosse gave us an assignment to that we, all of our characters, we were nameless, we were the core, you know, the ensemble.
Yeah.
This is when they had a lot of singing and dancing boys and girls, they called them, you know, and then the principals. He said, I want you each to write a summary of your character, your life, who you're, it's kind of like what you do in a basic acting class.
Sure.
I'd never heard of such a thing. And he said, every time you enter, you are coming from some place and know why you're coming there, what you were doing there.
Okay.
To every last chorus person, he said, this is your assignment. And what are your relationships with each other? And what was so brilliant about just fundamental basic things that he was giving us as actors was that it just, you know, touched our imagination and we could go on from there. And he picked people who were individuals, all sizes, shapes, as he did with all of his shows.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a... And Gwen, you know, was our dance captain. She was a great star then, of course. But between shows, that's what she loved to do because Jack Cole, you know, when they did movies together, mm-hmm. that she would work with him. So she was in heaven there with assisting, you know.
Yes.
But you're so intimidated because there's Gwen Verdon,
right.
You know, telling you to, could you move over a little bit to this person? And anyway, she was fantastic.
How do you overcome the intimidating factor, though, and just actually...
I never did, actually, with her.
Some people are just like that. You never...
Yeah. She's up there.
That's awesome. Okay, so I'm trying to move a little chronologically mind. Well, there's a lot to go through, so we won't hit it all. But didn't you, Ethel Merman, at one point, working alongside her, right?
Yes, I did. I did work with Ethel Merman, and I loved her, and I admired her, too. But she was... could be a long story, and I'll try not to make it, but...
I got all the time in the world. You do what you got to do.
She was intimidating. I remember I would have done anything to please her because I admired her, and we were in St. Louis and in the Muni Opera, and it's so hot, and I'm sweating and everything because I have a dance number because the choreographer knew I was a dancer, and so Ethel Merman sent a message back with the stage manager, and I said, oh, whatever, I'm so happy to do whatever, you know, she suggests. And she said to stop perspiring so much, it bothers her concentration.
So, she said that to you?
No, through the stage manager. And he kept saying, it's not for me, it's not for me, it's not my note.
Yeah.
I said, anything. So I was stumped. I said, okay, I'll do my best.
You're like, is that it? Is there any other, you know, acting or dancing tip? No, just stop sweating.
Well, she was very famous, you know, for saying to Jerome Robbins, what is this guy doing? And Jerry said, you know, he's reacting to you, Ethel. And she said, I don't react to him and he don't react to me.
So, that's just great.
Don't sweat while I'm talking.
Don't sweat while I'm talking. That was your famous line for her, to
my
you.
My initiation.
Yeah, there you go. That was your trial by fire.
But we became close after that, I must say. We're good friends. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So don't sweat it. What else? Is there anything you want to hit before we get to a chorus line?
Because
I want to hit the chorus line.
Yeah.
Anything else in there that I'm missing?
Oh, God, I don't think so. I was just lucky to go from show to show. And I thought, this is what happens. You just go from show to show until you don't.
Right. And you still are.
And then you go, oh, what happened? And then you learn about show business in a real way.
Yeah, true. Is it true that...
And this was just before Chorus Line, too, when I thought, oh, my God, am I ever going to work again? Every actor goes through that, but, you know...
What was that point for you? Was there like that low point right before...
Yeah.
Do you remember it vividly?
Like I'm not working. Yeah. Not working and and the business was changing. New York was in dire straits and...
Paint it for me. Are you in a little apartment in New York?
Yeah, and struggling and, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
where are you living at this time? Where in the city?
I'm living on 69th and between Central Park West and Columbus, which wasn't all that nice then. Now it's Tony, you know.
Yeah.
But then it was hard. I lived all over the city, but it was just a struggle, and you go to dance class, and they were a lot cheaper then, but you had to pay for everything, and voice lessons, and all that.
And out of this struggle and, you know, the doubt, am I ever going to work again, you start doing these workshops, right, that became A Chorus Line, right?
Yeah.
It started as workshops.
I kept saying to Michael Bennett, you know, let's hurry up and do this because, you know, I'm getting older, you know. Like, I mean, we joked about it, but it was 3 years before we started working on in the workshop that he and Bob Avian, that he had talked about doing something for dancers. And so it was a long time of it.
How did you, before we get into the workshops, how did you meet Bennett to begin with?
We were dance partners on a TV show called Hullabaloo.
Okay.
Which is a great show, actually, variety show on television.
They should run it in reruns.
It's great. It's fantastic.
So describe that first meeting. Do you remember it?
Well, yeah. He was terrific. He was a great dancer. And I kind of said, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? I mean, because you can't keep dancing your whole life. I already saw myself dancing my whole life and acting and transitioning into acting, singing, and, you know. But here's this, you know, fabulous dancer and a guy, and I just thought he's not going to be able to keep doing this kind of thing, you know. So what are his plans? And he said, he looked at me so sincerely and said, I'm going to be a choreographer. But he said it like he'd already arrived there.
Right. He had visualized it already.
It was set. Yeah. It was destiny there. And I went, ooh, it was... I said, well, don't forget about me. His first big hit on Broadway was a show called Promises, Promises. And I was already cast in it because I was trying to do that thing, transition out of dancing. And... So when Michael got on board as a choreographer and the show was out of town and they needed to cut the show, my job was going to be gone because I was a kind of a secondary figure. And so Michael said, well, she's a dancer. Let me put her in the dance number. And then he had this great number at the end of the finale of the first act. And it just made his work just, you know, it was fantastic. And I was part of it. So he saved my job. And it put me on the map in a way in Broadway, the first show. And then we did Company, which was a really groundbreaking musical. Sondheim, Hal Prince, Stephen Sondheim.
Of course, yeah,
that,
oh, yeah.
Right?
There's certain names you can just say the last name, right?
So bad.
Like McKechnie.
Yeah, yeah, right. Oh, wow. And Company was quite an experience on its own. It will always stand up. As a very unique experience, and history making. So then after that, it was Michael talking about doing this show. At first, it was going to be a murder mystery, a backstage murder mystery, and then it was going to be just on one set with dancers coming in and without talking, you'd see the relationships, and then it, you know, so
evolved.
It morphed into all these different things until we finally got Joe Papp to. Give Michael the theater, and he's carte blanche. He said, you know, take it away. He heard only a few minutes of this recording that we all made sitting around talking about our childhood, why we are dancers, and where we're from. Three simple questions that actually begin the show on a Chorus Line that the director asked the dancers, and that's how it really started. So Joe heard like 3 minutes of this and said, okay, I love it.
Who else sitting in this group? Remind me some of the actors. Was Marsha Mason part of it?
No. She was married to Neil Simon then.
Okay.
And after it was being performed down at the Shakespeare Festival, the Newman Theater, we were having some... My character was actually the most fictionalized because the story was an audition. But there was a relationship between the director and the character Cassie.
Right.
And because it was, Michael wanted it to be a secondary storyline to give the director kind of a dramatic arc emotionally, mm-hmm. and for Cassie too, to have it some, to raise the stakes. So it's not just an audition.
Right.
To complicate things. So she walks in and there he is. So this was the hardest thing to do. So Marsha Mason, who was a wonderful actress and friend of Michael's, came and watched the through line of this Cassie character and was very helpful. And
yeah, because I think that's what I read, was she offered maybe a slightly changed the ending, how
well,
it might turn out.
She has to get the job.
Cassie's the one that has to get it.
because we were so close to it, and I say we when I mean all of us, and even Michael, who was the first to admit that he needed another perspective, you know, somebody else's eyes, and he was, what he did that was so wonderful, I mean, so many things, but he was trying to be realistic. He was trying to be in a world now, after Watergate, where it was all about honesty.
Right.
And to talk about how all people suffer with these, you know, these feelings and frustrations of not being able to be themselves entirely. And so he addressed that, and he, because he was trying to be realistic, he knew if he was the director, he would not let her in that show.
Right.
Because he had too many unresolved conflicts about it.
Right.
And he didn't want to see that every day.
Yeah.
So Marcia says she has to.
So you need this outside voice.
She said, because if she doesn't, then everybody loses. Then he loses. He never advanced in his resolve. And she never was given the second chance. Which metaphorically, that's what people who weren't in the business universally saw it as, oh my God, the letters I got from businessmen who lost their jobs at that time and then had to start over again, the second chance theme rang through for so many people. I was surprised.
Yeah.
Football players talking about their lives on the line, the lines on the football field. They started relating that way.
It was a course amazing. Line.
Wow. Yeah.
A course lineman. A course linebacker.
Course
linebacker. You should have gone into football.
Oh, my God. No, but it's you know, it's like when you're doing something like that, you don't, it's not your job to, it's not our business to know what they, you hope it gets out there.
Right.
You don't know how people are going to take it. But it was very, you know, it's bigger than us, in other words.
Absolutely. Well, we talked a lot about sort of the creation of it and the changes and the story and who should get it in the end and the workshops.
Yeah.
What about actually memories of actually being on stage performing it? Was there a particular memory, a good story you can share with us, or, you know, a night you thought you really killed it?
Oh, my God, yes. The one that stands out for me is when we had this roaring success in this little theater. We were never publicized, the Newman Theater downtown. And people were flying in from the coast, they say, and you know, you'd have George Burns sitting with Diana Ross on a step because there weren't enough chairs in the theater, you know.
Wow.
And they were
on a step.
On the step,
in
side
the aisle.
By side, back there. And yeah, Groucho Marx came like 20 times.
Did you ever talk to him?
Yes, he gave us a big cake with a foot with an axe in it, like break a leg. It was hilarious.
That's fantastic.
No, we had fans, I mean, just
phenomenal.
Come all the time. And so I'm leading to when we were moved to Broadway, when we made that move, and people saying, oh, it won't be the same, it won't be that precious thing. And it was better than ever. But I remember having stage fright my whole life in every show, opening night, you know, it's a kind of a beyond nervous excitement.
Sure.
It's something, it's like a fear.
Butterflies.
And that was one of the most exhilarating, freeing, celebratory experiences because everybody on stage, all of us, opening night at the Schubert Theater, and the audience who had seen the show already, it was like a big party celebration. It was just, it was celebrating not just the chorus line, but theater and audiences.
Right.
And it was just a wonderful, glowing experience.
It's fantastic. Now, the music, was Marvin Hamlisch, was the music?
Yes.
Yes, we have to talk about the late great. He actually, he came in and did a thing for us here, like about, no one knew he was sick. And he played, you know, he played The Way We Were and, The Spy Who Loved Me. He played all those things and then he died a month later. So one of his last appearances was in D.C. But just memories of working with him. He is unbelievable. He is a legend and his music just gives me goosebumps. But what about sort of behind the scenes?
He was a great guy and a really big-hearted fellow. And funny and just a great composer. And he was a great entertainer. I do symphonies now of his work and other composers, but when we go around to the symphonies that he guested, I mean, people love his work. They loved him. And he was a workaholic. I mean, he never stopped. He just loved it. There are some people that that have the energy of about four people. They're just born that way. And Michael was one of them.
Yeah.
And
those are the best people.
Oh, my God. And they're so full of life and vitality. I met Marvin when he was just out of Juilliard. He was like 17.
Oh,
and
wow.
He played an audition for me. He played my audition for Sondheim the first time I met him for A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And he was a great musician then, you know. He was.
You guys go way back before this.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Isn't it funny how you start in certain places and then it all you combine?
And you're able to see over the years the shape of things.
Watching everyone grow. Yeah, that's fascinating. Tony Knight, memories of sitting there and hearing your name called.
Yeah, that was shocking. I wasn't well prepared. I mean, I had to be somewhat prepared, but.
You have a speech ready?
Sort of generally, but not really, because I didn't relate to it all that well. My father died like just a few weeks before, and so I was performing 8 shows a week, trying to, you know, keep above the fray. And I remember this. I remember that my mother was in the balcony, and my feelings. I was concerned for her. But yet, I thought, this is a major event. These are your peers, you know, this is... but I, you know, I was working very hard to keep myself there. But I remember saying to myself, going up the steps when I heard my name, which was kind of surrealistic, and everybody says that, but I went, okay, now I went into... the brain went, okay, now you're going to walk down the aisle and not fall. You're going to walk up these stairs now, as I'm doing, and do not trip. And there you're going to reach out. And so there was this guide in me, just walking myself through it. And then I was able to say the things that I wanted to say, pretty much. I don't know how I did it, because my voice didn't sound like mine. It was kind of like, I did it without breathing, I think. And then going off in the wings, and I walked into Richard Burton.
Wow.
Those beautiful, and I was such a, admired him so much, and those beautiful blue eyes, and he said, you deserved it.
Oh.
And I lived on that for about 5 years.
Yeah, well, Richard Burton, it's at least 5-10 years,
yeah.
Easy, right? You can coast on that for a while.
Oh, yeah. So it was wonderful, but it was a balancing act, you know?
Yeah. So does that just change everything? Once you have that, you can plaster it on, you know, your the old resume.
You can plaster it on your resume, but it won't get you work necessarily. Yeah, plaster all over the place.
Yeah,
it's a great honor. I mean, but it's not about, you know, and I'm not being coy about this, but I didn't come to New York to win prizes.
Right.
You know,
you shouldn't. You know,
no,
because if that's it, then you've already failed.
It's
you know?
Like fan mentality. You know, no, it's like it's not about stickers or. It's or getting a star in the middle of your forehead.
Right.
Although I never did that. I never got one of those at school, so maybe not. but no, it's about the work. And anyone who's had longevity that I've worked with will say that.
Yeah.
And it's gratifying. But it's that award in our business is still, you know, it's hard won because it's a theater is hard.
Yeah.
8 shows a week is hard, and nobody knows what that's like. Unless you do it. And there's something about when you... and I was a Tony nominator for a few years. They rotate people every few years to keep it more or less fair. But it's subjective. But it is your peers honoring you. And that is a great, great thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it does open doors. In Chorus Line, the show in itself is something never to compete with.
Is it still the longest running? What was
no,
it? Or it had a record
no,
for a
think,
long time, but I think it got broken recently.
Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah,
Cats
yeah,
and
you're
then
right.
Phantom of the
you're
Opera.
Right. But for a while it
oh
was.
Oh my gosh, yes. But it's still running somewhere, always.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
You mentioned opening doors. You started doing a little TV work after that, right? Dark Shadows?
Oh, this was before.
This was before
the
Chorus Line? Oh,
this
okay.
was like in the 60s.
Oh, okay. I'm trying to remember.
No,
weren't
this
you also
was before I
Cheers?
Did.
You did a little thing
yes,
on Cheers?
Yes,
yeah,
yeah. Well, Dark Shadows, I mean, they still have big conventions, and, you know, I was going to do a company, and they had to kill me off with a Pete Moss and Styrofoam Rocks, and that was my better memories.
And your better moments.
Yeah. Some great television in the 80s when they were still doing, you know, a variety of specials, and I miss New York too much, so I had to come back. I miss theater.
Yeah. Well, that's where you belong, and now you're back, we're so thrilled that you are back. I guess we just got to kind of just bring it full circle then. So, you know, we're back at Pajama Game now. You're still working. Like you said, you never did it for the prizes, and you're so right about that, because if those come, great, but they're not, that's not your North
Star. It's wonderful, and it does, and it does promote someone. I mean, now it's part of, I mean, it's still important, in other words, to PR people, you know, it helps. But, yeah, I'm still working. There's something, I have jobs for the next 2 years.
Ooh.
I don't usually have...
What else is coming up? What's after
Pajama?
Well,
there's something that just happened, and it's not signed, sealed, and delivered, but so I can't really say.
Tease it.
but it's a good thing for me. Awesome. And it's another show that I can go and keep moving and singing and acting and... And, you know, wonderful. It's wonderful.
It's great. Sort of in closing, final seconds. Everyone remembers you, for a chorus line. That's like, everyone remembers that. Which is there a role?
But that was a long time ago.
That's what I'm saying. But, I mean, you know, boom, that's the big one. But is there one that no one mentions that that was my favorite?
There are two. I mean, the one was at the National Theater with Sweet Charity with Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon. That was the night he left the planet, as it were, you know?
Yeah.
I love that role. But I think my favorite is Sally in Follies.
Oh, okay.
When we did it at the Paper Mill Playhouse. And Stephen and James Goldman were together again, still working on it. And I remember looking at Dee Hody, who was playing Phyllis, and I said, this never happens. 20 years later, after the original show, the writers come in and rework a piece like this, and on us, it's fantastic. So that was a great thing to do back then.
Awesome. Well, you've been more than generous with your time.
Oh, thanks, Jason.
So nice meeting you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you.